Okay, let us now go back to these objections again. The only one we're not going to revisit is the first objection, because I think that one was based upon a mistake, and I think it dealt with it adequately. But the second objection, and the third objection, and the fourth objection need to be dealt with a little more thoroughly. Now, in my article, for you that are going to read it, you'll notice that in the middle section, what I do is go into some of the contemporary literature on transcendental arguments in the philosophical literature. So I survey that to try to make the objections more precise, stronger, right? This is one of the things you want to do as a philosopher or as anybody who wants a thinker. If you have somebody who's criticizing you or taking a stand against you, what you want to do is to put their position in the best possible light, right? Best possible light. Make it stronger, tighten it up. And why do we want to do that? Part of the fall? Part of the fall. Sinful. We want to do that for two reasons at least. One is for intellectual honesty, right? Maybe you can think of a way to put it better. And so let's refute it in the strongest position. And then also because we don't have any worries about things, right? We don't have any worries as Christians. We're going to be able to answer it, whether it's in a weak form or a strong form. We're not interested in merely winning a debate at this instant in time against that particular person. We're interested in answering the fool once and for all. Now, that's the ideal, and we probably will never be exhaustive in that, but we want to do the best job we can. So always try to put your opponent in the best possible light. It's a Christian principle of charity. And also, we want to take on the best objections against Christianity, and we have nothing to fear. So in the middle section, I went through the modern literature, culled out of it some things that may improve upon and tweak and make more substantive the objections that I surveyed earlier. But we don't need to go into that here. Debbie's yawning. We're definitely not going into that here. Now, if you have a philosophical interest in this, then do not skip over the middle section, because that's, I think, some of the more interesting stuff. But we will bypass it for our purposes. Okay, let's return to the objection. This is on, if you're following it, I don't see many of you having the book, but it's on page 115, just in case. Recall that objection 2 against Tagg maintains that it is impossible to provide a uniqueness proof for the conclusion that the Christian worldview is a necessary precondition for experience. Remember, this was the criticism of the uniqueness proof. That Christianity, by this argument, refutes other worldviews, but doesn't prove that Christianity stands alone. Right? You may have refuted 10 worldviews, that doesn't prove the Christian worldview. This is due to the fact that there is no way of refuting all possible competing worldviews. Thus, even if all actual worldviews are shown to be false, and Christianity is shown to be a sufficient precondition for experience, it does not follow that Christianity is the necessary precondition for experience. Now, as one of the philosophers I mentioned pointed out, transcendental arguments, not the transcendental argument, but transcendental arguments in general, and by implication Tagg, do not set out to provide a uniqueness proof by refuting an indefinite or infinite number of worldviews. That is not the nature of them. Those that have studied transcendental arguments know that that's not the way that transcendental arguments work. That's a mistake to think that's what they're doing. They don't set out to disprove other things in order to establish one. By refuting an indefinite number of things in order to establish one. That's not the way to construe them. Rather, the proof is provided by refuting the negation of the conceptual scheme or worldview that one is attempting to establish. And this is basically what we said before in a little different way. The point of a transcendental argument is not to refute many things and pretend like yours is the one left standing. It is rather to take your view, and transcendental arguments can take many different forms, have various objects. So you take whatever it is you're trying to show is transcendentally necessary, and you contradict it. And you show that it is impossible to account for human experience on the contradiction of the position, worldview, conceptual scheme you're trying to establish. The proof is provided again by refuting the negation of the conceptual scheme or worldview that one is attempting to establish. It subjects the non-Christian worldview to an internal critique, specifically now talking about TAG, and shows that on its own terms it is contradictory, arbitrary, and cannot provide sufficient conditions of experience. So what we're doing is showing that the non-Christian worldview, which is what? Not just Buddhism or Islam, and not just all known non-Christian religions and ideologies and philosophies, but the negation of Christianity cannot provide the preconditions for human experience. Showing that, what have you shown? If you do this, right, this is what you're doing here, then you have left this. You have shown Christianity. What then is the nature of the non-Christian worldview? That's the next question, right? What is the nature of the non-Christian worldview? Simply put, all non-Christian systems presuppose that experience can be accounted for on autonomous lines. The non-Christian worldviews share the common feature that experience can be made sense of independently of God and His revelatory word. Thus, all non-Christian worldviews deny the creator-creature distinction. Say, well, what about Islam? It denies the creator-creature distinction because it says what? An implication. That it can be understood independently of God and His revelatory word. You say, well, it believes in Allah and it believes in the Quran. They don't say that. Yes, they do. It denies the Christian triune God and says the world can be understood apart from the true and living God's revelation to man. Thus, all non-Christian worldviews deny the creator-creature distinction as properly understood in Christianity. The doctrine of the Trinity, moreover, they all deny, and the biblical doctrine of man as being created as God's image. They deny the fall and the noetic effects of sin. By the way, in the R.C. Sproul Gerstner book, they talk about Van Til and that he overemphasizes what they call the poetic influence of sin or effect of sin. And the typo, that's pretty funny. It's noetic. What does noos mean? Mind, right? The effects of sin that are on the mind. It's mental, right? We believe in total depravity. And you all are good Calvinists. You know what that means. It doesn't mean that we're as bad as we possibly can be. Though some people come pretty close. But I won't mention Chris Treble left the room, so we're safe. But men are totally depraved, and every aspect of them is fallen. And so those that deny Christianity deny the fall and the noetic effects of sin. They deny the necessity of Christ's redeeming work for not only personal salvation, but also the salvation of the human intellect. They also deny the necessity of divine revelation, the foundation of all these doctrines. Now, this is a thumbnail sketch, right? I mean, this section of the article could be, I could just, you know, put in Calvin's Institutes from this point to the end, and, you know, that rest of it as well, right? This is just a thumbnail sketch. But in other words, all these doctrines, I'm listing some of the more obvious ones, but all the doctrines of the Christian worldview. From this, we can see that Van Til is correct. He says, we have constantly sought to bring out that all forms of anti-theist thinking can be reduced to one. All forms of non-theistic Christian thinking can be reduced to one. This is in agreement with what experts on transcendental arguments say is what you're doing in a transcendental argument, and that is proving the negation of what you're trying to establish. All non-Christian worldviews, say Van Til, can be reduced to one. Bonson elaborates on this insight. Despite family squabbles and secondary deviations among unregenerate men in their thinking, they are united at the basic level. I think of here the Muslim and the Jew, right? Shaking hands. They're united on a basic level, very symbolic. They're united on a basic level in setting aside the Christian conception of God. The indirect manner of proving the Christian position is thus to exhibit the intelligibility of reasoning, science, morality, etc., within the context of biblical presuppositions, and then to make an internal critique of the presuppositions of autonomous thought. Theonomy versus autonomy. Okay, we're going to prove theonomy, God's law, right, standing for the Christian worldview, by refuting autonomy. In order to show, make an internal critique of the presuppositions of autonomous thought, in whatever form it is presently being discussed, in order to show that it destroys the possibility of proving, understanding, or communicating anything. Close quote. Thus, the Christian apologists may boldly assert that without an absolute personal being as the foundation of all things, there is no possibility of ethics. Without the ontological trinity as the fount of all being, there is no possibility of unifying the particulars of human experience. Okay, well, let me explain this real quickly. Okay, one of the problems in the history of philosophy is one of the many, or one version of the one of the many, is universals and particulars, right? In order to do science or anything, you have to have what? You have to have a unity of our manifold experience, right? We want to know about ducks. We're not interested, remember, in Donald. We're interested in ducks in general. The only reason we can study ducks in general is because they share something in what? Common with each other. But we can't get to the universal without the particular. In fact, if there's no particular, then we would have a monism. And there would ultimately be no distinctions. So non-Christian philosophers are forced in one or the other direction. Either what? Monistic type of thinking, or what? Atomistic type of thinking. Bertrand Russell put it this way. He said, Hegel thought of the world as a glob of molasses, which is representative of what? Monism, right? Undefined, sticky unity. He says, whereas I conceive the world as a pile of buckshot. Right? And that captures it nicely. Okay? The non-Christian tries to understand the world in terms of monism, ultimately. Ultimately, everything is one. And then what do you have to do? You have to explain particulars from it. Or you believe and teach that the world is primarily, fundamentally, buckshot, atomistic, separable, independent entities. In which case, what do you have to explain? The unity of everything. Well, guess what? The greatest philosophers in the history of the West have tried to do both of those, and they've all failed utterly because you can't do it. You're going to try to explain the opposite, but in the end, you're going to have to really say that doesn't really exist. Unity doesn't really exist. Plurality doesn't really exist. What you have to have is what? What you have to have is a ground of all being that is unified and plural, right? The one and the many has to be in the fount of all being. And there we have the doctrine of the ontological trinity. God is one. God is three. What comes first? What is more foundational in God? His unity or his diversity? The unity of God or the three members of the Trinity? What is more foundational? Well, you've been taught too well. I like teaching some classes where people are not sure, because then you get to explain things. But the answer, of course, is neither is more fundamental than the other. Or they are what? Equally ultimate. They are equally ultimate. And every heresy in the Trinity emphasizes one or the other, right? If you emphasize God's unity, you're going to do what? You're going to deny the three persons of the Trinity in some way. You're going to have usually some subordinationism. Or God is the Father is something like the essence giver. You have to have some type of heresy. But if you emphasize plurality, then what do you end up with? Something like tritheism, right? So you got modalism on one side, and Sabellianism, and you've got tritheism on the other side. As soon as you say one is ultimate, one is prior to the other, then you are engaged in heresy. And the Bible teaches that God's unity and God's diversity are equally ultimate. And because of that, we can make sense of the world, because we need both unity and diversity in order to explain the world. And only Christianity gives it. And notice that it's not an abstract principle. It's not that we believe there is a thing that is unified and diverse and diverse. That, in a sense, is Plato's doctrine of the forms. Plato's doctrine, though most orthodox explanations of Plato won't tell you, explain it this way, but I think this is what's really going on. He has a form that is a universal, but it is also what at the same time? A particular. Okay, it's a substantive universal. And Aristotle took him to task for this. It's an impossibility because it's an impersonal thing. An impersonal thing cannot be unified and diverse. You have to have something that makes sense of that difference, and that can only be personality. God and his being is one, and his personality is three. And therefore what? We have a doctrine, we have a worldview that explains the unity and diversity of our experience, and every other worldview denies the doctrine of the Trinity. Every single one, every single heresy, every single non-Christian worldview repudiates. That's one thing that even if you're deistic, you repudiate the Trinity. If you want to attack Christianity from the inside, you go after the doctrine of the Trinity or the doctrine of Scripture. One of those two is usually where it is. And the doctrines of Christ fall under most generally the doctrine of the Trinity. So the Christian worldview can explain this, can explain the unity and the plurality of our experience. Without the ontological Trinity as the fount of all being, there is no possibility of unifying the particulars of human experience. Without the doctrines of both the Trinity and man's being God's image bearer, there is no possibility of predication and thus language. I'm using Vantillian language. What I mean there is meaning. Right? You're not able to account for language unless you have what? What is predication? Right? Saying the barn is red. So you're taking a particular and you're predicating of it a what? Universal adjective, but it's universal, right? It has some property, redness. So you're talking about both there. Now, without the ontological Trinity, you can't have predication because you can't have particulars and universals at the same time. But without God creating us in his image, right, so that we can think his thoughts after him to some degree, we could never have language in order to do what? To get in contact with the truths that God reveals us. We have to be God's image bearers. We have to have something of the mind of God to do this. So without the doctrines of the Trinity and the doctrine of man being created in God's image, you can't have language. That's pretty devastating, isn't it? You can't speak. Who is it that cannot account for speaking? Anybody that denies the doctrine of the Trinity. Without the doctrine of God's sovereignty and providence, there is no ground for inductive logic and science. Okay, we talked about that a bit. Without a good and all-powerful God who creates both man and the natural realm, there is no reason to believe that our senses are reliable. Okay, we can add to this on and on and on, but for these considerations and many others, it is clear why Tag is often described as an argument that proves the impossibility of the contrary. That's what Van Til used to say. We prove the impossibility of the contrary. Okay, we take Christianity, deny it, contrary, and show that it is impossible. And if you show the impossibility of the contrary, you showed what? About the contrary of the contrary. You show the necessity of it, right? If there's two things, and you show that one is impossible, you show the other one is not only possible, but you've shown that it is necessary, right? Basic modal logic, right? The necessary is possible, but not all possibilities are necessary, right? It's possible that I wore a different shirt today. It's necessary that God exists. Okay? But it's also possible that God exists. Because it's necessary, it implies it's possible. But if something is impossible, the contrary of that is not just possible, but it is necessary. So the impossibility of the contrary. There is at bottom one non-Christian worldview, therefore, and this worldview is easily reduced to absurdity. The philosopher I mentioned's insight is relevant at this point. When one version of the non-Christian worldview is refuted, the general non-Christian worldview is refuted, for all of them are variations on a theme. The radical relativists may at this juncture, so everybody get this so far, okay, the objection was, you're not proving the uniqueness of Christianity, you're just refuting a few non-Christian worldviews. Okay. That doesn't establish your worldview. Well, you're not construing what we're doing properly. What we're doing is showing that the negation of Christianity is impossible. Therefore, Christianity is necessary. How do you know you've done that? Well, because we take the ontological doctrine of the Trinity, we take the doctrine of revelation, we take the doctrine of the creation of man in God's image, all these things, and deny them. At any point, you can't talk about all of them at once, remember, but at any point we talk about one of them, deny one of them, and see what you come up with. You come up with the inability to use language, inability to make sense of the one and the many, the inability to make sense of morality, etc., etc. We're not just attacking a version of the non-Christian worldview when we do this. We're not just saying, well, the Muslims have a problem here. We're saying if you deny the doctrine of the Trinity, then you cannot account for our experience of one and manyness. And therefore what? We've refuted the non-Christian position, not just the Muslim position or the Buddhist position, the non-Christian position, and established the Christian position. Now, one more thing to say about this objection. The radical relativist may at this juncture assert that there is no way we can set a limit on what is conceivable. He in effect says that it is conceivable, or you can read it as possible, that there are other worldviews that are inconceivable to us. Okay, now this objection is from the relativist and says, look, we oppose, deny the Christian worldview and establish, by refuting it, the Christian worldview. But the radical relativist might say, yeah, but there may be, you're conceiving of things in certain ways, but there may be things that are inconceivable to us. You can only conceive of Christianity and its negation, but there may be other things that are inconceivable, other possibilities that are inconceivable. Now, that sounds like a contradiction, and it verges on one, but it's not quite. Possibility and impossibility and necessity are logical, metaphysical terms. Conceivability and inconceivability are epistemological terms. The objection is, yes, maybe we cannot conceive of alternatives, we cannot conceive of some things different between A and not A. But it is possible that there is something that is inconceivable that is an alternative, or showing that these are not the only two alternatives. If you don't like philosophy at this point, then you're saying, this is getting weird. Okay, I know it is, but this is something that people have contended. The contention about conceptual schemes from a famous philosopher called Donald Davison, is that it makes no sense to speak of a possible conceptual scheme that is inconceivable to us. Okay, I'm going to follow his argument. Right, this notion that they're driving at here is ridiculous. Okay, there is no possible conceptual scheme that is inconceivable to us. If a conceptual scheme is so different from ours that we are not able to somehow map it against ours, we will not even recognize it as an alternative conceptual scheme. Indeed, the very notion of an inconceivable conceptual scheme is without significance. Why? Because we cannot even map. We'd have to be able to map it to make some type of sense of possibility of it. The relativist contention that there may be conceptual schemes or worldviews so radical from ours that we cannot conceive of them, and that one or more of these conceptual schemes or worldviews may be able to provide a set of sufficient conditions for experience, thus is abortive. No sense can be made of such a claim, and with this, the fangs of objection 2 are effectively removed. Okay, so objection 2, right? You don't provide a uniqueness proof. Well, we show them that this is what we're doing, and they say, well, no, you're really doing this over here, remember, right? You're really doing this. this is valid, like this is valid, but there's other things besides A and B. Christianity, Islam. Christianity, Buddhism. Christianity, naturalism. But we come back and say, no, we're saying Christianity and non-Christianity. I say, well, no, that's not really what you're doing. We are doing that because we're only using Islam, Buddhism, naturalism as an example. In principle, what we're saying is deny the Trinity, deny the doctrine of God's providence, deny the revelation of God and His Word, and you have shown, we can demonstrate, that you cannot account for experience. And then this whole relativist bit, that, well, there may be inconceivable worldviews that are possible. That's just nonsense. Okay, we are not quite out of the woods yet. We're not quite at the restaurant yet, I should say. As we saw earlier, the critic of Tag offers a special version of this objection, which was the Christianity one. Objection 3 contends that there is another conceivable worldview that does provide sufficient preconditions for experience and thereby cuts off the proof that the Christian worldview is a necessary precondition of experience. This worldview is in many ways identical to Christianity, recall, right? Keep everything the same. We're going to change one or two little details. The example mentioned was that of Christianity. Christianity is identical to Christianity except for the fact that instead of a trinity, it has a quadrinity. With regard to this objection, the recent literature on transcendental arguments is of little help. Okay, so I'm just saying that's not helpful. The only way we know that God is a trinity is that He revealed it to us in His Word. But the Christian worldview, which is ex hypothesis, identical to Christianity in every way, asserts that its God is a quadrinity. But if the Christian worldview, right, this is now my beginning of criticism here, but if the Christian worldview is otherwise identical to Christianity, the only way for us to know this would be for the Christian God to reveal this to us. In other words, where is the Christian Bible? Right, if this is possibility, give us the Christian Bible. But notice that by positing, but there's a problem with this. Supposing the Christianity had inspired scriptures, which it would need to have since it is in all their ways identical to Christianity, right? If it says that's identical to Christianity except in the doctrine of the Trinity, part of the Christian worldview is that it has a scripture. So the Christian worldview is going to have the scripture. These scriptures would have to reveal that the Christian God is one in four. But notice that by positing a quadrinity, the Christian scriptures would be quite different from the Christian scriptures. Whereas the Christian scriptures teach us that with regard to man's salvation, God the Father ordains, God the Son accomplishes, and God the Spirit applies, the Christian scriptures would teach to us a very different order. But exactly how would the four members of its imagined Godhead be involved in man's salvation? Right? I mean, you see where this main criticism is going. We're just going to change Christianity at one point. And then we can say, here's another, not real, but a conceivable worldview that does provide the preconditions for human experience. So we're just going to change it at one point. Oh, you are. Okay. What point is that? We'll call it a quadrinity. Okay, so just one point, nothing else changes. Right. Okay. What's wrong with that? You can't change Christianity at one point. You change Christianity at one point, said Ben Till, you change it at what other points? Two or three, I think it was, right? All points. You change Christianity at one point, you change it at all points. And here I'm just giving a basic example. We believe in a quadrinity. Okay. What about the ordering of God's decree and God's accomplishments of salvation? God decrees, the Son accomplishes, the Spirit applies. What is your ordo salutis, your ordering of the decrees and the accomplishments of salvation? How do you conceptualize it? How do you understand it? Well, they have to give an answer to it, right? Because it's Christianity in every way except the Trinity. But now you have to start going in and doing what? Fixing this here, right? Whatever you want to call them, A ordains, B and C accomplish, and then D applies. Or whatever ordering you want to do. It's going to change the doctrine of the way of salvation. Now, of course, it's going to change many other things besides that as well. But exactly how would our four members of its amended Godhead be involved in man's salvation? But more fundamentally, whereas in the Christian Trinity we read that the personal attribute of the Father is paternity, the personal attribute of the Son is filiation, and the personal attribute of the Spirit is spiration, what would be the personal distinguishing attributes of the member of the Christian quadrinity? What would their relationship be to one another? Okay, now, we're just going to mess with the doctrine of the Trinity. Oh, okay. But what is the relationship that the Father has to the Son? Or, since you don't have a Father or Son, what about A to B? What's the relationship? Okay, to say that we're just going to change Christianity at one point is to say something that is absurd, right? It's to say that you're just going to change it at one point and pretend like it's not going to have any impact in other parts of the system. But that can't be. What would be their relationship to one another? Further questions flow out of this. How would the quadrinity affect the doctrine of man and sin? How would redemptive history look different? What about eschatology? This all needs to be spelled out in detail. This illustration reveals a general problem. One cannot tinker with Christian doctrine at one point and maintain that other doctrines will not be affected. It does no good for the proponent of Christianity to claim that the only difference between his worldview and the Christian worldview is over the doctrine of the Trinity. Christian doctrine is systemic, and a change in one area will necessarily require changes in others. It is necessary, therefore, that the advocate of Christianity spell out how this one change in doctrine affects all other doctrines. But once this is done, there is no guarantee that the result will be coherent. We'll be charitable there, right? Okay. Well, we have. Now, remember, the earlier objection, there's no uniqueness proof. No, we have it. But now here comes somebody claiming. So we've dealt with all of the worldviews, in essence, right? There is one non-Christian worldview. Now, here they come and say, well, we'll think of one. Here's this one. Okay, this also can provide the preconditions because it is just like Christianity, only different at one point. Well, no, it's not just like Christianity at one point. So spell it out. Give us the Christianity Institutes. Give us the systematic theology of Christianity. Give us the Westminster Confession of Christianity. Give us these things. It's not enough just to say, well, we're just going to change it at one point. Without providing the details, the Christian theology of Christian theology, this objection has no punch. It can only be thought to be a challenge to Christianity if it, like Christianity, provides preconditions of experience. But without knowing the details, we cannot submit it to an internal critique. Until this happens, we can conclude that there is no conceivable worldview apart from Christianity that can provide the preconditions of experience. Now, at this point, and this will be the last point before we go off to dinner. At this point, the proponent of Objection 3 may attempt one last desperate stand, as we are now, too, right? We have to listen to one last objection on this line. Okay. He can argue that we can take Christianity as it stands, and rather than replace one of its doctrines with another, simply remove some distinguishing feature of Christianity. Okay, now this is a little bit different. Christianity said, we're going to take Christianity and change it at one point. No, that's ridiculous. This objection, this move, is to say, no, we're going to keep Christianity, but we're going to do what? We're going to remove some feature of it. Now you see where this is going, right? Is this going to be any improvement? Whether you add or subtract, is it going to matter? No, of course not. This is what the desperate move is. For example, rather than positing something as problematic as a quadrinity, the objector may simply invent a religion identical to Christianity except, say, that the book of Jude was never written and thus has no place in its canon. Okay, so we're going to say we're Christianity except for there's no Jude. Not that we don't have it in the canon, it never was written. Now, what's the answer to this? This is not a worldview that is different, relevantly, from the Christian worldview. All it is really doing is asking us to think counterfactually about the Christian canon, right? Counterfactual is one of the few areas in the English language where we have the subjunctive mood left over, right? If I were a rich man, I would be driving a white Lamborghini convertible. Right? Okay, that is in the subjunctive mood. It's counterfactual, but I'm not. Right? But I'm not. Usually, conditionals are not in the subjunctive. If you do this, then this. Right? That's in the indicative mood. If I were something, or if it were the case, then this would be the case. That is subjunctive, and it's often called, by philosophers at least, a counterfactual, something that's contrary to fact. And by the way, philosophers have had a time trying to handle these things logically. Right? They have an if-then, they're conditionals, but how they're handled logically is still the subject of a great deal of debate. Anyways, counterfactual. We can think counterfactually. It's asking us to think counterfactually about the Christian canon. That is, the answer we give to the counterfactual question, did God have to inspire Jude to write his epistle, is, of course, no, in one sense, right? Did God have to do that? In one sense, no. Right? Another sense, yes. But furthermore, for much of redemptive history, God's people did not have the privilege of reading Jude, Old Covenant times. And even in the era of the church, Jude's canonicity was not universally acknowledged until the 4th century. Well, does that mean it wasn't part of the canon? Until the church decided that it was part of the canon? Well, the church didn't decide it was part of canon, did it? What did it do? It's acknowledged, recognized, right? Okay, but there was a time that it wasn't generally acknowledged, right? That Jude was part of the canon. It was part of the canon always, since the time it was written, but it wasn't always acknowledged. So, for much of redemptive history, God's people did not have the privilege of reading Jude in the Old Covenant times. Even in the era of the church, Jude's canonicity was not acknowledged universally until the 4th century. Are we to infer from this that the Old Covenant people, or certain 2nd century Christians, did not have a genuine Christian worldview? Did Moses not have a Christian worldview? Did Christians who were in areas that did not receive the Epistle of Jude, say in early 2nd century in parts of the Roman Empire, are we to say that they didn't have a Christian worldview? Okay, that's ridiculous. Such a conclusion is absurd. Okay, so this objection is absurd on those grounds, but it's also absurd on the grounds that whether you add something to Christianity or you take something away from it, you're going to change it. And once you change it, what happens? You start to change it at every point. Okay? So, with this, objection 3, as presently advanced, is not at all an argument that is demonstrative or even plausible that Christian theism is the precondition against the conclusion that Christian theism is a precondition of human experience. In other words, this argument is understood in either way of no use. It doesn't advance the cause. And so objection 1 we've talked about, no good. Objection 2 and 3, which are variations, very similar, but they're both no good. And then when we come back from dinner, we'll talk about the 4th one, which I believe is the most difficult one to deal with.